Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of Powerful JRE. In this episode, the guest shares insights about their latest music project, emphasizing the authenticity and rawness of the recording process. The conversation highlights the collaborative spirit and the unique approach taken to create a sound reminiscent of classic rock bands. This engaging discussion promises to reveal the creative journey behind the music. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Long time no talk.
Yeah, brother. Yeah. How you doing? You good?
Good. I remember like towards the end of the last time I was here, you said, oh yeah, we'll probably see you again in a couple years. And I was just looking around like, yeah, I'll never see any of this again.
You're back quicker than you thought.
Yeah.
Bro, that new song is fire.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. Woo! I played that song about 20 times in the green room. And the first time I played it, everybody just sat around and went, oh, shit.
It was so funny that, I didn't expect the song. I wasn't the one. I guess it was Adam that sent it to. I don't even know how you got a hold of the song originally.
Yeah, Adam sent it to me originally.
Yeah. I'd sent it to him just to get his opinion of it or whatever. And he's like, I got it. He's like, do you mind if I share this around? And I was like, yeah, go ahead.
Bro, the first time I heard it was in the green room. And the green room has a killer sound system. So we put it on the Bluetooth and cranked it. And all of us, it was like 10 dudes in that room going, oh, shit. Oh, shit. Some of those lines, like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Woo.
What makes that song different, I guess, than anything I've done or than a lot of music now is that we tried to, like, do it the way Lynyrd Skynyrd or somebody would back in this, where we're all just in the house and there's no, like, man, there's so much editing that goes into music now on the back end and stuff. And with this, we're just, like, in there doing it and, you know, try to keep it as real as possible. Like, you know, there's no click tracks. There's no real editing. It's just kind of like we're all just in this house. I mean, it was the worst timing to record, but that was that January 5th, 6th, 7th window was the only time that everybody could meet up. You know, Billy Contreras on the fiddle and everybody, and because he tours with Ricky Skaggs and he's kind of all over the place. So that was like our time to meet. So a couple days before we all went to West Virginia to record in my house up there, this like terrible storm they were calling for. It's like the worst one since the 90s, supposedly, or that's what Draven says. But so we got all the snow, all this ice. So we used a side by side and a Jeep to haul everything up and down. It was like just all we could do to get up and down to the house. And then it's right as soon as we get everything plugged in, ready to go, the power knocks out. And I was like, we were all just so discouraged. And luckily, there's a Lowe's not terribly far away, and they had like a Honda inverter generator that was like safe to plug everything into, you know, like where the waves aren't going to mess everything up. And we recorded the song while on a generator.
So you have to worry about the waves of the generator, like the sound of the generator? Well, like, is that what it is?
No, like the
electrical pulses?
Yeah, like plugging all of that expensive equipment into just like a generator that's not an inverter, like the voltage like goes up and down, I guess, or I don't know, that's all above my pay grade. But yeah, we had to find one that was like safe to plug all that equipment into, you know.
Maybe that's something in the song too, you know, like maybe that you're trapped in a storm. But that's a scary ass song, dude. It's a scary
I can't wait for the I hadn't put a lot of new music out because well, I think back to even when I was here last time and before we did the episode and all, walking around on the sidewalk out in front of the hotel with Draven and a couple other people arguing that I needed to just cash out from Richmond and roll and not make this into a long-term thing. Cause I just, I just don't, some people thrive in this environment, like everybody looking at them, but to me, it's just like, it kind of takes a little bit out of me putting new music out. And so, you know, after Richmond, I only had those two new songs. I really just wanted to let everything kind of slow down, and I could still maybe do 5 or 10 shows a year and make a little bit. But I wasn't trying to be like a superstar. I didn't want everybody just to be. I didn't want to be stuck in that spot I was when I was at Richmond, where everybody's just like obsessing over stuff. And so I kind of just tried to let it die, and then it wouldn't. It was like the streams kept continuing, and people were still messaging me and emailing, and the shows were still selling out. And I just realized, like, I don't know, you know, I believed everybody that said, this kid's got 15 minutes of fame and whatever. And I would have been, during when Richmond blew up, I would have been one of those guys who would have been like, oh, that stupid guy, you know, like I would have been a hater too. So I was almost like rooting for them. Like, yeah, you know, cause you got to think, man, the first check from Richmond was $800,000. Like I could have lived a long time off of that money, you know, like yeah. I don't need a whole lot of, like, that was crazy. You know, that was
right.
A decade or more of work for me easily. And right. So I was like, heck yeah, I'm good. I'll just take it, you know? And anyway, I say all that to say that now it's like I'm gonna at least just hit it good one more time. We've got six songs recorded now to come after Scornful that are all like I'm pretty proud of them. They're good, and so I'm gonna put those out, and then who knows after that. But
let me tell you what's gonna happen. You got a relationship with those people now, man. They love you.
Yeah.
It's just your mission in life. You know, you just got handed a wild hand of cards, and this is your deck of cards. You know, your deck of cards is, or your hand of cards is, you put this song out, this authentic song that's very simple in this time where nothing's simple, in this time where everything's confusing and you don't know who's telling the truth. The news is lying to you. Everything is being funded. Nothing's organic. It's half the fucking traffic on social media is bots, at least.
Yeah.
Politicians are lying. Everybody's confused. People are simping for politicians. They're getting paid to repeat talking points on television and on podcasts and all over social media. So when someone comes out with something like that, is just that dude telling you how he feels.
Yeah.
Real, raw. You know, I remember we had that conversation on the phone, and I was like, if you can do that, you could do that again. They don't need anybody else. You don't need these motherfuckers who want you to cash out. All these they're doing that because they think that you're gullible. They think that you're naive in the ways of the entertainment music business. The first fucking live show you ever performed was a giant sold out show at a state fair. You know how crazy that is? That's your first live show.
Well, that very first show was actually, it was even more amateur than that. It was at a farm market. It was, there weren't even any tickets. It was just like, so it's crazy how it goes back to when I still believe just as much now as I did the last time I was here about, and I definitely won't bug everybody too much with all my hokey pokey religious stuff either. Like, I definitely want to read a little bit out before we go, but I do believe it was all too perfectly timed. But I had actually picked that date out at the farm market before Richmond blew up. That was going to be my first time playing live either way.
Oh, wow.
That date, it was like August the 12th, I think. I had booked it back in July with that Morris farm market.
Oh,
I was going to get $200 and go play for like, it was like 2.5 hours. Like, seriously. And in that time, that's what happened. So, like, I already had that date picked. And yeah, it was just at a farm market and like kind of near the beach in Outer Banks. And they say like 12,000 people showed up. And that was the very first one.
Having reflected on the unexpected success of that first performance, the conversation shifts to the darker side of institutional power, particularly how the church has historically masked its own corruption.
Within the church and all the, like, so much stuff that the church was doing wrong that would get kind of covered up and brushed to the side. And it's just, it's really crazy when you read into all that, like how much corruption existed back then. You know, now it's easy to point to corruption in government and in society and everything else, but it's not like, the church is more dead now than it is corrupt, I'd say. But back then it was just like this power hungry thing, you know, and that to me, that's not real church. That's just, like I said, that's just government or a regime using church as using God as a way to control people. But it's a lot different than what church should be or could be.
For sure. I mean, that's just a function of human beings when they get in power. Human beings, when they get in power, they want more power. Like, if you're in the automobile business, and you're making cars, you want to make more cars. I want to make more cars. I want to sell more cars.
Yeah.
Got to sell more cars. If I'm in the power business, I want more power. I don't want this amount of power. I want more power. These people are trying to take my power away. I want extra power. The best way to keep them from taking my power away is to get more power and get it so that they can never take my power away. You know, lock it down. Make the elections bullshit. You know, make it like Russia. Hey, Putin won again. Everybody clap.
Have you seen that video that went around recently of, I think it was in Romania, but there was like an overthrow that happened in a day. It was from back in the 80s. It was a, I think it was like a it was a dictator that it was over Romania, I believe. I don't know. I'm not on the internet a whole lot anymore, thankfully. I remember watching a bit of this video where this is like a Romanian dictator who had, he had been in power for like 20 years and had done a lot of oppressive stuff, but overall was like maintaining power. And then at some point, a police officer or a military official or something shot, I think like a preacher or a pope or something. And the dictator dude took the side of the police, and it sort of was like a cultural shift. And basically, like, he went to give this big speech and all these people showed up and they had applause playing over loudspeakers, but really the crowd was there to like mob. And within like a day, they had like taken the whole government over, the whole military turned against them. It was a big video that just got uploaded about it. Whoa. Like maybe a month ago. I think it was Romania, I believe. But it was so quick. It was like he went from being in this position of power and like ruling over everything and having just extreme wealth and the whole military at his disposal to everyone turning on him, and he was publicly executed, I think, the day after that speech. But that was just something I watched. Here we go, yeah.
Executing a dictator. Open wounds of Romania's Christmas revolution. Whoa, they did it on Christmas. Damn. Wow. And there's a video on this?
Yeah, there's a video on YouTube that somebody sent me that I was watching through. It just showed, though, going back to like, if enough people have their minds made the same way, they can just pretty much do anything.
Wow.
But I believe it was within like a 2-day period that all this happened. He went from being in power to being publicly executed, and they held up elections afterwards. And like, and I don't know all the history of it. I know very little, but it's just something that seemed really interesting to me that I was never taught this in school or anything. I know that, but of course I didn't pay a whole lot of attention while I was there either. So maybe I did get taught. I don't know.
There's been so much war in that part of the world, man, for so long. It's like baked into the ground. The crazy shit that's going on in Ukraine right now. Have you seen that they're flying these drones that you can't jam? And the way they are, they have like miles of fiber optic cable attached to them.
Yeah.
This is so crazy. They're like fishing. They're like fishing with a drone. And now birds are making like nests out of this fiber optic stuff. They're picking it up and like, oh, this is perfect. Make a little nest with this shit.
Did you see how they got those drones in for the attack on the planes recently?
What did they do? They drove them in trucks, right?
Yeah, they were like, I don't know if buried is the right word, but they were like secretly in the trucks, and then like they all came out at once or something. Like the roofs opened up of these like log cabins or something.
They all came out and they all went out and attacked all
the
planes.
Sheds. They were sheds loaded on the trucks. Stuck around the perimeter.
Fucking ingenious, man. And they said it took like a year and a half to come up with this plan.
This will change war forever, though, I guess. I mean, artificial intelligence will too.
I'm reading a book about it right now. a fiction book, one of the Gray Man books, that is specifically about using autonomous weapons. It's The Chaos Agent by Mark Graney. It's about a guy who's this billionaire who develops this autonomous weapons program. But they're doing that. They're doing that right now. And we don't know like how advanced China stuff is. Like, but we know their drones are insanely advanced. Like their drone shows that they put on, they just put on another one recently, like the largest ever drone show. And you watch these coordinated things in the sky that are creating images, and you're like, that 100% could be a weapon. Like that thing you can get that thing to be so precise. Mm-hmm. They coordinate together. All you'd have to do is like put a suicide drone, look at this thing. Look at these things, bro. These are drones. How nuts is this? I mean, that is fucking bananas. Look at that. I mean, it's crazy.
I've heard, you know, this is all just generalization stuff, but I've heard people make pretty compelling arguments about, like, you know, all these sort of, like, prophetic visions of the end of times, all the stuff in the sky and all the imagery and all that, that a lot of that could be. I don't know. I see a time coming very soon where warfare is conducted with these drones, and also with like probably ground machinery too. Like you see, they've got Tesla bots and other variants of that are able to catch tennis balls and organize groceries. And these things are all fed off of artificial intelligence, which knows everything about all of us collectively. It sees where we go and what we do and what we say and what we shop for and what we look for and how we drive. And it's like this, almost like this very godlike thing. And I don't think that it even matters whose AI it is, if it's China or ours or some private company. I think it's like at some point it will just be the thing. thing. We won't. It won't even be China's AI anymore. It will just be.
Yeah, it'll say "fuck you, China." You know, we're taking over. We don't believe in countries. We believe in the hive mind.
How do you stop that? Like, you don't. How do you like it? Goes into industry and creativity and almost everything that a human can provide outside of very select few things can be emulated and replicated and done by it. It makes us practically irrelevant in the eyes of.
In a lot of ways, it doesn't make us irrelevant in art, because you're always going to want art from a person. You're always going to want art. You're always going to want paintings from a real person. You're always going to want music from a real person. You're always going to want.
I don't know though. Like I think AI is already like deeply ingrained in music. I don't know. I'd bet a lot that most of the new big song, the big hot songs that get written and just the big, I think AI drives all that. I know for a short period of time, I used a social media company in Nashville. There was also a period of time that I used a management company in Nashville. And both of those girls I worked with at both of those companies who were helping me with social media stuff, they even had AI like trying to write my captions and stuff. And I would always just like, it was always the most dumb sounding stuff, but it was like, If they would take pictures from after a show or something, and they would want to make a post.
Having delved into the intricate psychology behind our online behaviors, the conversation shifts to the curious dynamics of fame and attention in unexpected places. As the discussion unfolds around personal experiences and societal perceptions.
At least you were in a regular airport.
Southwest.
The worst is when people are doing those things in front of a private jet. I'm like, okay, we get it. You're rich. You know, if people try to take photos of me in front of a jet, I'm like, yeah. I'm so not into this. I don't like the attention. I don't want it. I don't need it. Which is weird because I got a lot of it. And I think it's probably why I have a lot of it, because I'm not looking for it.
Yeah, but you're also able to, you're channeling it out through all these other, I mean, think about all the things that you've influenced and been a part of and done, even just through this podcast and all the conversations had and the information shared. Like, it's not like you're just posted a bunch of pictures with your shirt off, like, hey, look at me. Like, you're using it. I mean, I don't know. I almost would say I don't know that it's a coincidence that you got put in this spot for a lot of reasons. I mean, there's a lot. You probably don't even look at it that way, but there's a lot of important things that come out of this. And all the other podcasts you've inspired that have done. I mean, gosh, dude, there's no way to even calculate what you've. If you had never been born, there's no way to calculate how different things would be now.
Like, well,
that's important to think about, though, you know? Like, it's.
Sort of. But from my perspective, I was just one piece in this thing that happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I always have my friend Adam Curry on, who's the original. He's the podfather. Without him, there would be none of this. He figured out a way to do this. And, you know, and then also Anthony Cumia from Opie and Anthony and Tom Green. Those are my number one influences. And then Adam Carolla already had a podcast when I started. I was like, oh, Adam went from radio to the internet. Maybe I could do that. I remember going to his place and I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. It's back when we were doing it on a little laptop. I'm like, wow, Adam has like a real studio. He's got employees and shit. And then, you know, we just kept doing it. Just kept doing it, you know? Yeah. And then eventually it was webcams. Okay, now it's not just a laptop camera, it's actual webcams. Okay, now maybe we should get, like, real cameras. Okay, let's get real cameras. And then, like, maybe we should get a fucking studio. So we tried it at the Ice House for a little bit. And, like, maybe I should get another place. Then we got another place. I'm like, I think I need a warehouse. And then, like, I think I need armed security. I think I need fucking special ops guys around me all the time. And then it just kept going, man. I remember the moment, and I've talked about this before, but I didn't understand what was happening until one day I was on stage in Chicago. And I think this was 2012. So I think it was around then. So the podcast was only 3 years old, and I didn't realize how many people watched it or listened. A lot of it was listening at the time. Because I don't look at the numbers. I just kind of keep, I feel like all that's bad for you. You know, reading the comments, looking at the numbers. I just like, do what you do. That's why I do it exactly the same way. I have a bunch of people on that no one has ever heard of, you know, and then a few Bonos and stuff, you know, every now and then I'll have Russell Crowe on, something crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, that guy's here. Dennis Quaid's here. This is nuts.
Yeah, your Mel Gibson one was good.
Yeah, oh, he's the best. Yeah. But I was on stage in Chicago and I was telling the story about the podcast. I go, how many guys listen to the podcast? And he went, it was like 3,700 people in this place. Mm-hmm. And they were all screaming. I went, whoa.
Yeah.
That's when I realized, like, at that moment, I was like, holy shit, how big is this thing going to get? And this is another funny thing. When I went over to Spotify, I was trying to get 10% less famous. That was my goal. My goal was to fade away. My goal was, like, if somebody has to pay me and you have to go to this app to get it, all the people that are getting it the other apps will probably stop listening.
Yeah.
Like, this would be great. I'll get all the money, and I'll just fucking drift into this place where it's only, like, the hardcore fans that make the trek over to Spotify. And then this fucking COVID thing happened. Remember in the beginning of the podcast, we lost 50% of our views, and Jamie was in a hot panic.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant earlier about not putting a lot of songs out. There's like a there's some cool place where you can be where you're where you have your real fans and you're having fun, but you're not into all the sensationalism, all the crap, you know, like
you can avoid all that. Yeah. You're a real guy. You're a real dude, and I think one of the ways that the world has prepared you for this is that you've lived a normal life for a long time. You know, a normal life with no live performances, no notoriety, no fame, no nothing. You developed like a like when people want to hear working man songs, you fucking know Bruce Springsteen isn't a working man. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like he probably was never really a working man. He was never working on the docks. You know what I mean? He was never really a guy grinding it out. He became famous pretty fucking young. You know, Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band, they got hot. Early, like they're great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, especially his early song, Born to Run. Fuck, he's got some jams, dude. Yeah. He's got some great songs. You know, Brilliant Disguise. Oh, fucking love that song. But you're a real working man. Like you were a real working man when you made Rich Men North of Richmond. Like that is real. And you can't fake that. And people want that. They want a fucking trucker hat. They want ripped jeans. They don't want, like, ripped jeans that are ripped from work. You know what I mean? They don't want, like, real oil stains on your knees because you're fixing your own car. You know? Yeah. Like, that's what people want in this world. They want authenticity. And it's possible to maintain authenticity regardless of how big you get. It is possible. And I think you can do it. I think you can do it because you got here later in life. You got here and lived a real life, and then you made it into magical fantasy land where we all live.
Yeah, well, the thing that I've gotten the most from you, like I say, I don't look at my streaming numbers or anything either. That's what I mean. Like when I finally did go back and look at Spotify, like after a year and a half later, it's just like, oh my God, like this is still the thing, you know? But I agree with you there. I don't look at the numbers. I do catch myself reading a lot of the comments, but only because a lot of them are important, and I think some of the stories in them are important for me to. I don't want to completely isolate myself from that. And like I said, I also really like some of the negative ones too. I think, and the negative ones are a lot less now than they used to be. It was just really early on, people didn't understand how everything happened, and I really didn't understand it either. That's why it's like whatever, you know. But moving forward now, yeah, I've got a good like core team of people. I've got Draven from Radio WV. I've got two or three people on staff. I don't have a management company or a publicist. You
perfect.
Know,
that's the key.
I'm keeping it real, tight. Real low. Well, I mean, it just amazed me when I came here for the first time and saw the staff you have. And then like meeting Lex, you know, Lex does all of it. He even turns his own cameras on and stuff. Yep. There's only Lex in the whole place. It's like, gosh, I don't need all these. It's like a lot of those positions and jobs and services that musicians use, I think they don't realize that they don't even need. They just are like, oh, that's how it is in music. That's what I want to change. I want to, yeah, I don't
it
know exactly.
Eliminates the executive influence. It eliminates the corporate mindset. It eliminates that because there's always going to be a person that wants you to make a decision that's better for you financially. Whereas like your instincts are guiding you towards this artistic decision.
Yeah.
And anytime those people get in the mix, they fuck everything up.
I'll give you a great example. It's like the only like call out on here that's negative that I'll say at all is that just to show like how stuck in the mud the industry is and how much I think it's going to change in the near future is leading up to the Scornful release, me and Draven had went back and found about 30 or 40 people who just – without us even knowing who they were, made the Richmond reaction videos, and they were a big part of the push of it, especially long term, you know, like people on TikTok and stuff that had made these videos.
Having navigated the complexities of artistic integrity and industry pressures, the conversation shifts towards the foundational concepts of citizenship and national identity, delving into how these ideas shape our understanding of America.
And you have, and like, there's like, yeah, like it just seems like without citizenship or without some definitive thing of who's a citizen or not, it's like, then it's not even a country. It's like, And most every country has some, like, the idea of there being no immigration laws for a country means that it's no longer a country. But I also think it's like the opposite side of that too is like America's always, in theory, even though it's always been ran by these, there's always been these corrupt people involved in it. In theory, you know, America was was started as sort of this thing that was like, that could maybe be like a sanctuary that like, that like doesn't allow the, doesn't allow monarchies and dictators and horrible things, you know, like as bad as America maybe has been in certain cases, like the fact that when Japan lost, they didn't just go and take it over and call it another part of America. Like they went and tried to rebuild, like in theory, America is supposed to be this vein that exists of, you know, its origination is from people who wanted to get away from monarchies and dictators. And of course, like it's so easy to pick on the founding fathers and all their faults and the crazy things they did, but it was centuries ago in a different culture. And they probably were all maniacs. You'd have to be a maniac to go up against the world's biggest empire and take it on, you know,
with
like
a musket
with a fucking, yeah, like you have to be crazy. And of course they had personality flaws, but they were, the reality is that here's the thing that sucks is like, and it goes both ways. There's a lot of things about people on the left that people on the right don't realize that they have in common. And it's the same way with this. Like it breaks my heart when people just totally trash the founding fathers, not because they were these morally, they took horrendous shits too, I'm sure. Probably not as bad as Beyonce, but pretty close. And you know, the fact, like, of course they were bad people. They were all bad. We're humans. We're flawed inherently. Even the best of us, even the ones who act like we're the best and the most, like, we're all screwed up. We all have our problems and our faults and stuff. But the fact that they were willing to, like, go somewhere to another land with all these, with all this crazy stuff and then take on the, you know, the world's biggest empire at that time, just so they could be able to do what they, you know, religious freedom. It's like the, they didn't want religious freedom because they were, not even necessarily because they wanted to go to church. I always thought it was like, it's so weird that they were fighting for religion, but it wasn't they were fighting for religion. They were fighting for the mandate of religion, for the, they were tired of the church. And like, I know it's not considered the church anymore, but there is still a church that dominates us and tries to control us now. And that now, unfortunately now the church is just sort of this weird thing, but it's the zebra mentality, you know, among politicians. It's like it goes back to that. I think it's Jordan Peterson that talks about the zebras and how they'll do a study on zebras. And they'll, it's in the Maps of Meaning book, I believe. And they'll mark one red to study it. And then the predators take that zebra down because the zebra's stripes aren't camouflaged to their surroundings. They're camouflaged to each other, so they're not easily identifiable. And so four or five lions can't take one zebra down if they all look the same. And in politics, I believe that's what's happened, especially on the left, you know. I had people in Nashville quit working with me because I talked about this when I was at the Ryman, but we had this dancing, this chick that plays the fiddle and she does like flat dancing and stuff named Hillary Klug, who lives in Nashville. And we had her come to the Ryman to do this show with us. And, it was on a last minute thing and I'm about to introduce her and I tell the crowd, I'm like, hey, you know, I said, I got Hillary about to come out. And I was like, but it's not, don't worry, it's not that Hillary. And just made a joke about it. Well, somebody said something in the crowd that was, and I don't know, I just interact and I just say what comes to mind. And I don't care, you know, I don't worry about all that stuff and what people might think. I just try to say what I feel. But I was like, you know, isn't it crazy that somebody like Hillary, who not that long ago, I can remember vividly and as a child or in a teenage years, like being completely against the idea of even having two people of the same gender be married. Like, she was as against gay marriage as like any person on the far right is now, you know, and that was in my childhood or early teen. And I said, and now the fact that now that it's okay for kids to become transgender and go through like what Michael did, that's to me is just, it just shows that it's all theatrics and that none of those people really have any real like opinions about any of this stuff. It's all about what'll sell, you know, like, again,
did you say this at the Ryman?
I said this at the Ryman. And so I had my management company that I was using then drop me and a bunch of other people without even telling me. They just emailed my attorney and said they couldn't work with me anymore.
Wow.
They were that mad about that, which tells you how far off the deep end. But anyway, it's just...
Well, everything you're saying is just a fact.
But you're exactly right with all that. It's just... it's difficult to convey that to people because there's so many emotions involved. But at the end of the day, it's like... I don't see a whole lot of difference in people on the left and the right anymore. I think we're all just like you said, we all are trying to just effectively accomplish the same thing, just in different ways. And it's really easy to get angry at somebody that's on the same level as you than somebody that you don't even know exists, which is like with these private equity companies and these people in the background that do all the, like, it, the enemy that so what's happened is going back to the zebra thing, what I think has happened is, like, especially in politics, the reason why Hillary Clinton can be against gay marriage and then for transgender kids in a very short period of my lifetime and a whole bunch of other politicians with her is that they're all just constantly rearranging their stripes so all the zebras look just alike, because as soon as one of them looks a little bit different, right. You know, like
that's a great analogy.
Like Tulsi Gabbard or whatever, I don't know, name. Uh-huh. There's plenty of people besides, that's just the first one that comes to mind, that's like, you know, trying to be a Democrat and upholding most of what the Democratic Party would have wanted her to uphold up until very recently, but because she didn't rearrange her stripes, it's like, you're dead. But there's a whole bunch of more like her too that aren't even in politics anymore. But that's the way I see it now, is it's like all these people. And so, like, even with Big Donnie, you know, I wonder, like, yeah,
Big Donnie.
I see. I just wonder, even I just don't trust. It's kind of my Alex Jones syndrome, but it's like, no matter how cool somebody seems like that, I think, like, man, does him and Hillary really still chill? Like, they're probably smoking a fat joint right now, just laughing. I don't know. Like, you just don't really know. You don't really know. You're just, you have to see what you see, and you have to take it in and just hope that you have, that somehow you have the discernment to know what's true or not. But you really just don't. I mean, even with me, man, so much crazy stuff that gets said and done, and I just don't even, when things come out about me that aren't true, I just don't even reply or acknowledge them anymore. I just let them exist in their own little space and be part of it. And I've just decided that, again, we're just in this crazy thing where all this stuff happens, and it's just, I don't know. You can't.
The problem is so many people that don't do that. They're not aware of how much influence is being peddled onto them, how much their mind and their opinion is being affected by this nonsense on social media, by bots and by all these different things.
With the complexities of perception and influence laid bare, the conversation shifts to the intriguing dynamics between prominent figures like Trump and Elon, diving into their motivations and the implications of their actions.
But, you know, I...
apparently they're making up.
Do you think things are cool now?
Supposedly they had a long conversation on the phone.
The argument behind it was that they felt like Trump wasn't letting Elon... See, I don't know what to think of. I really don't know what to think of any of that situation or Elon in general. And it really fascinated me that it seemed like they were both using Doge for different reasons, maybe, or they had different motivations behind it. But what if it was like a genuine, what if there was genuine audits done on everything? And like, what if all that stuff did get uncovered? And what if somebody wasn't scared to just release all that stuff and the consequences of it? Like, people do deserve the truth. Like,
well, they've released some of it, right? So we know a lot about USAID now. We know what that was. We know what crazy programs are in place. We know through Mike Benz's work, where the way he describes USAID as doing things that are too dirty for the CIA. You know, like, he describes it being used for regime change, but under the name aid, it seems like it's just aid. Oh, we're helping people. Yeah. But it's Agency for International Development is what it really stands for. So there's that. That's been dismantled. The thing is, they're not spending less money. They're spending more money. Mm-hmm. They're spending like $1 trillion on the Pentagon. It's the whole thing is kind of nuts, because nobody wants to stop spending money. Nobody wants to lose their job. And they're all in a position where they have influence. And there's thousands of different points of influence. And if you're the president or the vice president or, you know, any of these fucking people, it's a very difficult road. One of the things that I felt like was the most important was Bobby Kennedy. Because Bobby Kennedy getting in there, he was determined to find out what is the root cause of America's massive health crisis that we're all facing. Like, why are we having this? Why do we have different toxins that are in our foods that are banned in Europe? Why are we allowing the use of these different things that we know are terrible for the body? You know, why is there not greater scrutiny on these pharmaceutical drug corporations? Why are they not, you know, why are they able to lie and get away with it and prescribe things for people that don't need them and not be responsible for the health consequences of these things? And that this needs to be cleaned up. And so that's what he's doing right now. I'm very happy. And I hope that he can really make meaningful changes, because it seems like he is. He fired the 17 people that were the head of the vaccine schedule, and he's hired a bunch of new people. They're all very qualified, and one of them being Robert Malone. Robert Malone, the guy that everybody said was a kook that I got in trouble for initially for having on my podcast when they were trying to, you know, like when fucking Neil Young was trying to get me removed from Spotify. This is over Robert Malone. Robert Malone, who owns 9 patents on the creation of mRNA vaccine technology. Certifiable genius, like unquestionably. They were calling him a kook. This guy's a kook. A guy who took the vaccine and had a horrible reaction. They were calling him a kook. So that guy being a part of this administration, being a part of the, you know, Make America Healthy Again movement, very important. All that stuff is very important for everybody, not Republicans, not Democrats. And if there's any area where we should be bipartisan on, it's that. And realizing that corporations have taken advantage of loopholes and of a bunch of different creepy laws that have allowed them to poison you. And you're getting poisoned and you're addicted to this poison. Mm. And there's a way out of this.
Well, he's kind of where I got the inspiration for the cult idea from. You know, he and I actually met. He came out to the property where we filmed Richmond and all, and I met him. This was before he got linked up with Trump. He was still running. This is during all that, and he was still running for himself. But we had a long conversation about this concept for a healing center, which is like this thing that he's been kind of like as a part of all this, which is kind of the idea of people going out into nature and like learning how to grow food and learning how to like, because in this never-ending abyss of chaos where everything's changing so fast and nothing, you know, nature has been affected by that through like some, you know, through chemicals and technology and other things. But for the most part, it's all the systems in nature, all the organization there and the all that stuff is sort of like the last thing that's untouched by man. You know, when you go out on 200 or 300 acres and you just sit there and you're watching the water go by, it's like you just sort of you take everything that we've talked about, like all this, these are all very complex, like just crazy century, thousands of year long things that that mankind have done. But meanwhile, nature just sort of exists and does its thing, and it's like it's sort of a way to compartmentalize all of this monstrosity into one little thing and realize that there is a reality outside of the reality that like modern society has constructed us to exist in 24/7.
That's 100%. 100%.
Like, gosh, dude, that's the only thing that saves me is like, especially being probably a little bit too introverted for this job position. You know, going out on tour even for a weekend or two, or like, dude, by the time Sunday comes and we get through this and these two mothership shows, we got West Virginia next weekend, but I'll spend this whole week, I probably won't talk to anybody except for like immediate family. You know, I'll just go sit out in the woods with the dogs and just watch the birds chirp and all that. But it's
amazing.
There's something really important about that I want to understand, like, if you can take 200 or 300 acres, like what can you plant on it that brings in the types of nature that benefit human beings the most? Like, I want to conduct studies on like everything from birds to plants to wildlife to different types. Like, how do you put a human being who is so screwed up in the most optimal condition to heal and to fix? Like, because it's obviously not the case. Like, you're not going to go to a mental institution and I'm not even suggesting for people who should be in a mental institution. I just mean, like, you know, people who, like, a guy I know who, you mentioned mushrooms and stuff, but there's a guy I know, like, that's in the Marines who's dealing with PTSD. Like, how do you get him into a spot where he can just go out and, you know, like, you can't, it's hard to fix that part of your brain living in a city or living in a suburb and not having that, like, so that's, you know, so yeah, it's just like this crazy dream I have where like it's sort of a it's a way to rebel against all of this without rebelling. It's just creating a better way to do it. But imagine if he's like, this is like the pilot program for this thing where it's this sort of outdoor amphitheater and it's like very immersive and in nature, and you can like re-unlock these parts of your brain you talked about that are sort of very primitive and to us, and then just emulate it over a period of time. Like, so I'm doing these shows where they're nonprofit, and the idea is just to go into an area that hasn't had music, that's in an A or B ticketing market, do a show there, build them a blueprint, whether it's on a main street or in a farm field or whatever, but just somewhere where Live Nation and Ticketmaster can't touch it, build them a blueprint with like ingress, egress, promotions, how to...
Having envisioned a unique blueprint for immersive music experiences, the conversation shifts to the uncertainty surrounding upcoming releases and the creative process behind them.
Like, when is it going to come out?
I don't know when the next ones will. I don't even want to say a date because I don't know. I'm such a procrastinator. I want to say like within a month or so. Like,
what are you doing with it? You changing anything on it, or are you just not releasing it yet?
Just not. I've just got. I just need to get my life together a little bit.
We'll just release it right now.
Put it just out release on the show. It right now.
Put it out on the show. Send it to Jamie.
I'll play like 30 seconds of song. I don't even have like a full file of anything on here. I've just got stuff that I've recorded off my phone, but just to give you an idea of like some of the other stuff I'm working on, like this one, let me see. Which one of these? They're all just say like new recording 432, so I got to remember which, like probably this one's probably one. I don't know if this will be right or not, but this will give you an idea of something. I just got a bunch of little clips like that of where we were practicing the guitar parts. But anyway, I got a few more that are like pretty heavy. I don't know what they are. I don't know. People will figure it out. There's something. I don't like to even try to describe any of that stuff because I don't know what it is. But
so are you going to release it all as a full album or are you going to just do it like song at a time?
Probably just song at a time right now just because it's simpler that way. Yeah, and then I'll just – I don't know what the long-term – plan is. I'll get to the end of this tour this year in October, and
you don't need a long-term plan.
Yeah,
just keep doing what you like doing.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah, this all long-term plan shit, that's people with vision boards. You don't need.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, no, you're right. I've just tried to take it. I do have to think long-term though, because I want to make the most of this just for, I don't know, man. The only thing I want, like, I just want to look back when I'm old and just think like, fuck yeah, we did it. Like,
well,
we did this
thing.
Well, if you
just keep doing what you're doing, you will do that 100%.
Yeah, but I mean bigger. I just want to watch the machine crumble, you know? Like, I have this, like, thing inside of me that...
It's going to probably crumble on its own. It'll still exist in some form, but, you know, as long as you can thrive without it, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. And more people will realize that there's a way to do it that's authentic. There's always going to be people that are drawn to that. And it'll be more and more people as things get more and more disconnected and feel less and less human.
Yeah.
There's
been so many big people go up against it and not be able to quite figure it out. Like even Pearl Jam back in the 90s, you know, trying to go up against, I think, Live Nation it was, or Ticketmaster. And I don't know, man. I just want to see. That's like the... That would be my biggest that would be the biggest thing that I would feel some sense of accomplishment about a long time is like, just how do you get all these people together who have been disenfranchised by the music industry and just rally them together in a way that, like, it's not to take anyone down or to do anything bad at all towards anybody, but it's just to, like, imagine what society would be with real music again without a bunch of label propped up shit and stuck in everybody's head. Like, what if people really listened to what they loved and, like, like, it was real. It was like the organic side of things is what drove music through the roof. Like, because think about what music can do to you, like, not even in the moment, but just what it means to you over time. Like, going back, and I go back all the time, like, and I listen to like a 1999 live, like a live Stained session or something from back then, and just, or like old Hank Williams III songs, or like, I don't know, stuff I listened to a lot as a kid, and like, man, it'll just unlock all these memories. You think about, like, all of a sudden you're like back in a place that you never even remembered you ever were. It's just, it's such a powerful thing on us, you know.
Excuse me.
So
sorry, I had to sneeze.
Yeah, but that's
It is powerful, man. It's powerful to do what you're doing. What you're doing is that. You're doing that. Yeah.
Well, I'm not doing nothing.
You're in that groove. Shut the fuck up. You are. You're in that groove. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. It's awesome. And it's inspiring, and more people are going to do it. And I love that you want to help more people do it. That's great. Because I guarantee you there are these Charlie Crockett's out there. There's these guys out there that people haven't heard of before, and then you see them playing on a street corner one day, and you're like, where are you from? Like, how are you doing this? This is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, there's people like that out there in the world. I remember we went, what was that place that we went to? We saw Ellis Bullard, the white, what is it called?
White Horse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were like, look at this fucking guy.
Here was, in town, right?
Yeah, nobody there.
We went there last time we were here. We were planning on going back. We was actually thinking about trying to swing by there this evening and
great
see
little
who's
spot.
Playing. That was so much fun last
great
time.
Great little
yeah.
spot. So there's people like that out there, you know? They just have to get an audience.
Yeah.
You know? And someone has to, you know, give them a little boost. Reach back. Grab their hand. Help them up.
Yeah.
So we all do that for each other. So it's mm-hmm. like there's a real pathway. So there's a lot of people that moving to Austin from all across the country, you know, that like, hey, I think if I get there, that's a place where you could really launch from.
What's powerful about your platforms here, like you and just and all the other people, like you said, that are in that network, is that you, this is all stuff that you've built, that you have control over. Like these are, that's what's cool about it, is it's like this sort of new, it's a whole new business that you've kind of got here. Like in the comedy world, it's not owned by anybody or anything. It's like it's wild and free and chaotic, and it could go anywhere. And that's what's exciting to me. It's like, dude, like I said, I just don't know. I just don't know what. Who knows what'll even come of what you got going on here and Austin. But this has shaped a lot. Like in a world where everything is so predicted. Like there's less and less people able to sit around in a boardroom in a skyscraper somewhere and decide what the next big thing is going to be. It's like, it's exciting to be a part of that. Despite all the, there's so many ways that you can look negatively about everything going on, but there is this sort of transfer of power that I just hope can happen. And we only have a very short window of time for it to happen in though, you know, pretty soon we'll all have a Neuralink and we'll be talking to each other and beep, boop, beep, boop, 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 you know, but we've got a little bit of time maybe before that.
Yeah, maybe. I think we're the last real people.
We're the last people that knows what it was like before to understand what real life really is. And it's so hard to even say what that even means. But I just mean that, like, even already there's people on YouTube that comment on a video that's AI. Everyone in it's AI. The whole narrative is. And it'll have like a million, and like probably half the people commenting on it are bots too. But I just mean that it's not even like we're going to be deceived that way. I think at some point it'll almost somehow it'll come to a point where we won't really understand what is real life or what is digitally artificially created. And it won't even, it's not that we won't even be able to tell the difference, but we won't even care to tell the difference. The fake world will feel more real than the real world in a short period of time. Somehow like it'll influence our sensory, like it'll influence that more than real life will. Like it'll become just like everything will just feel. I mean, it already feels that way. That's why we're so drawn and all. But as it all becomes more realistic and more creative and more tailored to draw us in, it will be just mass deception. This
what's
is no,
it might have already happened. This is what's really terrifying: is the simulation theory. The idea that I would be able to know if it was a simulation. Would you? I don't know. You know, Elon thinks it's a simulation. He thinks the chances of it not being a simulation are in the billions. He thinks that this whole thing is probably our consciousness interacting with a program, which is very bizarre to think. But if you keep going with what we're doing right now, that is inevitable.
With the unsettling implications of simulation theory lingering in the air, the conversation shifts to the transformative power of jujitsu, revealing how mastering its complexities can reshape one's perspective on life and conflict.
You do, the more people, you'll be able to get it in people that even know it's coming. You'll be able, it'll sharpen that technique up even more. If you can get people that know what you're doing, and you tell them what you're doing, you can still do it. Like Hicks and Gracie used to tell people, I'm going to get you in an arm bar on your right arm. You're like, the fuck you are? And he would still get it. But he was so much better than everybody that he would do that on purpose. And there's a beautiful thing about learning something that's very difficult that prepares you for life. Also, the other beautiful thing about jiu-jitsu in terms of your mental health is that it's so difficult to do that it makes regular life easy. And regular conflict seems to be silly. Like sometimes people get like super nervous if two people are just yelling at each other and you think a fight might break out. If you're like so used to strangling people, that's like totally normal. Like, oh, you guys got to fight.
Like you see that in this, yeah. You see that in some of the videos that go around where somebody will get like broken into, like they're, and it's like the security footage. Like I'm trying to think, there was one that went around recently. like some guy was trying to break into a UFC fighter's truck and he went out there and just like kicked his
Justin
ass.
Justin Gaethje.
I think that was it. Yeah.
He tried to carjack Justin Gaethje and he beat the fuck out of him. Yeah, the guy did that with John Jones. John Jones ran out with a shotgun and a fucking Belgian Malinois. Like, that's the wrong dude to break into his house. He's ready. And Sean Strickland, that was another one. Sean ran outside.
That's who
his
I was thinking of. Was
the pistol?
Sean,
yeah,
I was thinking of that one. I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of the you could fuck with the wrong dude, and that happens. There's a lot of those wrong dudes out there now. There's so many people that are training in martial arts now. You never know. Like, if you're picking a fight with someone and you don't know how to fight, you are rolling the
those
dice.
Those dudes are a lot scarier in real life than on TV too. Like, I
hell yeah!
I finally got to meet. I've met Brock Lesnar a couple times now. I've just ran into him randomly, and just like the size of his hands, you're just like, God, like what? Like, where did this guy come? He's just like a machine. You
He's
know?
A Viking. That's 100% Viking DNA. 100%.
But I don't know there's no exercise I'm aware of that like makes your fist twice the size of a normal man. But
it's
he's
genetics.
Just like, yeah, he's just like. Made.
You seen his daughter?
Yeah,
his daughter's a shot put champion. Like, jeez Louise, she's a tank.
Yeah,
that's just pure Viking genetics, man. Those are the people at the front of the boat with the big battle axe. When you saw that boat pull up to your village, you knew you better start running to those mountains.
But God,
son.
I just can't imagine having to get in the ring with a guy like that and like, no, you gotta. You're just like, God, like, good luck.
I know.
You know.
Imagine that the guys beat him too. That's what's even crazier. Guys beat his ass. You know, Alistair Overeem beat his ass. Cain Velasquez beat his ass. There's guys better than him, which is really
There's always
crazy.
A bigger fish, yeah.
Yeah, and Cain wasn't even bigger. Cain was a bad motherfucker. He was like 240. He was like 25 pounds lighter than Brock, and he still beat his ass.
Who in fighting right now is exciting you, like, coming up into
God.
It? Like,
There's
who's
so
good...
many guys. There's so many, man. Did you watch Merab's last fight last weekend? Merab Dwabishvili and Sean O'Malley? That guy is insane. He's insane. His cardio is like something that everyone who has been involved in the sport for as long as I have is blown away by it. The guy's a freak. Daniel Cormier went to visit him after he won the title. He won the title Saturday night at the Sphere in Vegas, beat Sean O'Malley, dominant five-round decision, just steamrolled him. The next day, Daniel Cormier goes to visit him. He's out running. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Doesn't stop. Just this guy from Georgia, from this, you know, war-torn country, who is just embraces that fucking grind at a level that nobody else can compete with. And when he gets in the ring, like, no one can match his cardio. No one can match his pace. He melts the greatest of the greats. You see guys like Umar Nurmagomedov, who's elite. He's world class. Like, at any other time, he would be a world champion. And Merab's just overwhelming him. You see him just getting overwhelmed by the pace. And Merab doesn't even get tired. He's a freak.
So he's probably trained in Georgia most of his life then. Do you think that gives him an advantage? Like, he's trained in, like, sort of maybe his fighting style? Or is it just like, is he doing the same type of fighting but just better, you think? Or is
well,
it just that they can't
read?
Well,
you can see the evolution of his technique. So a lot of it is in America. So it's just his mindset and his drive. And I think some of it, you know, Firas Zahabi did a whole video about him saying he needs to be studied in a lab. Firas Zahabi, who runs TriStar in Montreal, is like one of the greatest gyms of all time. And he's one of the best minds ever in the history of MMA. And he's blown away by this guy. He's like, there's guys that are on EPO, which is like, you know, that's the cyclist take that makes you have more blood cells and it makes you have more cardio, but it's, you could have a fucking stroke. It's like super dangerous to take. But that's like a lot of the like Tour de France guys get busted for that kind of shit. Some fighters get busted. He's like, guys that I know that have been on EPO don't have that kind of cardio. This is crazy cardio. This is like something freakish. And he's like, he thinks some of it's genetic, but Merab says it's not. Merab says, no, I used to get tired. But he's just, I mean, he's a freak. He's a freak. And he just keeps getting better with his technique. He gets better with everything. That drive is not just for his cardio. That drive is for his whole skill set. So he's a fucking monster. And then Ilia Topuria, who's fighting Charles Oliveira at the end of the month, like, that guy is insane. That guy's knocked out two of the greatest featherweights of all time, Volkanovski and Max Holloway. Nobody could knock those guys out in featherweight before. And he did it. And he did it, and he made it look easy. You know, he made it look like they're like he's just on another level from everybody. You know, and then now he's moving up to 155 pounds. He's like decided he cleared out that division. And he's moving up. Like he's
insane. Yeah,
insane. There's guys like that are just so their level is above everybody else's level. And with Ilia, it's everything. It's his submissions, his kicks, his punches, everything. He can do anything. I mean, he does everything perfect. All his technique is perfect. He's fucking driven and ultra confident. You know, this is an amazing time for the sport, man. It's a crazy time because these guys that are coming in with like one fight in the UFC, they look like world-class contenders like right away.
Yeah. Well, it's cool because it seems like it's a really good way to get like obscure people into the spotlight. Like it seems like if you can just go in there and fight good that you it's like you can really work your way up to the top pretty quick, I guess. Like I guess it does take some fights, but like if you're like the guys that are in the top at the UFC now, how many fights do you think it takes them before they wreck it? Like how many big wins? Is it really just a win or two, I guess, if they're big enough and they're like—
It really depends entirely on their skill set and who they're fighting and how good they are when they get into the organization. Like, the best example of a quick rise to the top is Alex Pereira. Hmm. But Alex Pereira is one of the greatest kickboxers of all time. And Alex Pereira, when he entered into the UFC, like, a lot of people were completely unaware of him. And me, as a giant kickboxing fan, he was the guy that I was like, when this motherfucker comes over here, bodies are going to drop, man. I'm telling you, you ain't never seen nothing like that. And I remember Daniel Cormier saying to me, like, really? I'm like, dude, I'm telling you. I was pointing to him in his debut. I go, that's the motherfucker. That's the boogeyman of boogeymen. I go, he knocks people into orbit. And I was showing him some videos of kickboxing fights, and he was like, holy shit. I go, dude, everybody he touches, he's got the touch of death. And then we start steamrolling people in the UFC, and he knocked out Strickland in one round. And the opening fight that he had when he hit that dude with a flying knee and just sent him into orbit, and everybody's like, whoa.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.